Accession number 20671, Reel 4.
I think I remember saying to somebody at the time, there's no way can we lose with all this, you know, when you looked around and you saw what was going on. And every second the Air Force was overhead in droves, you know. And apart from the air raid on the night before, you know, when we were there in London, I mean, there wasn't a sight of the Luftwaffe at all. All the aircraft were ours, British and American. And all the Royal Navy ships around, huge army of flotillas and battleships and everything you could imagine.
So you landed where, do you know?
I think it's called Lommel in Normandy, on Sword Beach.
So how is it getting off?
The Doddle. A doddle. This flap thing just arrived and put the ramps up to it, and we just drove the vehicles off onto dry soil. It's, we never even got the track wet, I don't think. And they took us up to a field, and I think we spent the rest of the day taking off the waterproofing that had been put on the engines. This was a messy, horrible job.
So was there any fire sort of landing anywhere near the beach when you arrived?
No, when we landed it was quiet. There was gunfire inland. Mm-hmm. And of course the Royal Navy was still firing from out at sea. Mm-hmm. We could hear the naval shells idly going over. And as I say, I think we spent the rest of the day just getting all the black bitumen off the engines.
Leo Rumley, end of Reel 3. Leo Rumley, Reel 4. So, you drove straight away to a field, which was what, quite near the coast?
Yes, it was about a mile or so inland, that was all. Yes.
Right, and you took the bitumen off?
We took the bitumen off and we got our rations and fed and so on. And I think we probably stayed there for a day or so, I don't know. One of the first jobs we had was we left the anti-tank guns and we made up some armoured car crews, and we escorted a small convoy of 3-ton trucks to make a dash for the American beaches because where they landed, they lost an awful lot of their equipment, and we took ammunition and food and stuff to the Cherbourg Peninsula.
Right.
for the Americans.
Do you know which bit of the American forces?
I don't, actually. They had two beaches there, and we're not quite sure which one it was. Because in those days, of course, we didn't know anything about names of beaches or whatever. We just knew that they were running short of supplies, particularly ammunition, and they asked us if we could rush them across overland. Mm-hmm. And we did, and the only thing I remember about it was that, that the Americans were disappointed that the cigarettes were British and not Americans. They were used to much stronger cigarettes than we had, but they were grateful for them all the same. Yes, and then we came back again, and the next event I remember was we went to Hill 112. And I think virtually every unit in the 53rd Div went there at some time or other.
So do you know what date you went there?
No. It'd be the dates between us landing in Normandy and the time we actually broke out of Normandy, you're talking about 7 or 8 weeks. And so dates don't really amount to much. It was lovely summer weather, I know that. Beautiful summer weather.
So Hill 112 was your first notable?
Yes, and we took over, I think, from the 15th Scottish Div, and they'd already prepared, or they'd already dug in on this hill. And I was lucky because the foxhole that I got, there was three of us in it, and it had a roof on it. And I remember one of the main supports of this roof was a German rifle that had been put across, but it had an earthen roof over the top. And the luxury of all luxuries in the slit trench was that at the bottom of the slit trench it had been widened out. So you had a little slit trench going horizontal, which meant that you had all the earth above you at that point. And we were grateful for that, because I think we'd only been there a very short time when we heard these morning minis, as they called them, coming over. And we just sat there on the top of the slit trench, you know, idly looking around and wondering where they were going, where they were coming from. And we soon realised that they were coming to us. They were intended for us. And my first real shock was that I got in the slit trench and was crouching down there, and a mortar actually hit the roof of the slit trench. And you could feel the noise. You could feel the explosion in your eardrums, in your head. And you thought, well, you can't tolerate that sort of thing. It was so loud and terrifying. Anyway, we were all right, all three of us. We were all intact and so on. And we just got out and we shoveled some more dirt on the top that had been blown off by the mortar. And we thought no more about it, you know. But for that instant, it was really a terrifying experience, the first one. Yeah.
First time you were
the first
fire.
Time, yeah, you ever. Nah. But after that, you become blasé, and you can pick out those that are coming near and those that are not, and so on. And you could differentiate between one and another. You could hear the naval artillery going over. And they used to sort of idly whisper across, you know, just a whispering sound going across. That's because it was so high up, I suppose, really. Just like a vague whisper. And then about 3 minutes later, you'd hear something explode, you know, about 10 miles away.
So how long did you stay there, and what was your purpose in being there?
Well, I think the thing was to just get us a bit battle-hardened, you know. And the next thing I remember was the... in the night, in the middle of the night, we used to go out with the ambulances, picking up the dead bodies that had been notified, and putting them into the ambulances, and having to bring them back to the first aid depots. And
so, whereabouts were you going out to? Was there sort of no man's land ahead?
That's right. Yes, yes. Yeah, we'd come off the hill, I think, then, and we were on the flat ground, but there was casualties every day. And they were just marked on the map where they were. And we used to go out at night time with the Austin ambulances.
That was the RAMC, was it?
That's right.
Yeah.
And we'd put the bodies into blankets and stitch them up and then put them into the ambulance.
What sort of job was that?
And I think the ambulance had... they'd probably have two or three stretchers in them. And we'd load about six or eight bodies into them. And ride back on the running board of the, you know, there's no room inside, so we used to ride back on the running board of the ambulance.
What sort of a job was that to do?
Well, as they said, you know, somebody had to do it, and you just couldn't leave them lying there. And I suppose everybody took the turn at it. It wasn't the job for the recce, but I mean, we took our turn in doing it like everybody else did, I suppose.
What effect did that have on you? I mean, probably the first time you'd seen...
Yeah, it's a bit sobering. Yeah, and the thing I remember, funnily enough, it's a strange thing, but I remember thinking how wobbly they were, the bodies. Even sewed up in a blanket as the truck was going along the rutted roads. They were wobbling about all over the place, and I thought it was a bit strange, really. Well, it's something that you don't think of, but you know, but when you see it, it seems a bit strange.
Yeah, no muscle.
A bit unreal, that's right, yeah. You know, whereas you could ride the bumps, they couldn't. They were just wobbled about all over the place. Yeah.
So, your impressions of the REMC then? I mean, some of them were non-combatants, weren't they?
Oh yes, yes.
You know, what was your impression? What was your
well, the opinion? The only members of the RAC we met in that instance, of course, was the ambulance drivers, because when we got back to the first aid units, of course, the bodies were taken out by the REMC, and maybe the Pioneer Corps, I should think, probably unloaded the ambulances, because they had the job of burying them to start with. So. But of course, everybody had a job to do and did as best they could under the circumstances that were there.
So, who was in command of you at this time? You know, who was your immediate superior? And
well, of course, the anti-tank crews. There'd be five of us in the carrier.
Mm-hmm. And what sort of jobs? You had specified jobs each.
Yes.
Day. Right. Tell me about that.
Well, there'd be the driver. And there'd be the commander, usually in our case it was a corporal. We used to call him Lofty, I forget what his surname was now. I know he came from Cambridge. And there was myself and two other gunners. I was the gunner, we had a loader, and we had a layer. And the layer would observe where your shot was going and correct you. And the loader, of course, would be the one that would be loading the shells into the gun.
So when was the first time that you fired your gun in?
The six-pack, yes. Mm. It would be while we were still in Normandy. And we soon learned that in the kind of warfare that we were engaged in, that observation posts, OPs, were vital. And, of course, in order to be effective, they had to be above ground. And so church towers, water towers, and high buildings were obvious points for OPs. And when they had an OP, they invariably had at least one or probably three or four snipers with long-range rifles. And the first time we were called in was that... one of our infantry regiments had come under fire, and they thought that the observation post was in this water tower, which we could see across a couple of fields. And this water tower had, from what we could see, wooden either logs or sleepers of some kind round the outside of it, presumably as some kind of protection. So Lofty said to me, "Do you think you could put a couple of rounds through that tower?" So I said, "Yeah." So we stuck the gun through the hedge and lined it up. And I fired an AP shot, which is an armour-piercing shot, because I thought we had to get through this surrounding woodwork to get to the tower itself. And, of course, the idea was to frighten them, to get them to get out, if they thought they'd come under attack, that they would leave it. I mean, we couldn't see them, you know, the individuals, but we knew that probably was the place where they were. So I fired two armour-piercing shots. And I can remember Lofty saying to me, "I thought you were supposed to be good. You've missed it." I said, I couldn't miss it. I couldn't miss it. So he says, "Well, if nothing's happened," because he's got the binoculars, you see. So I said, "Do you want me to put a high explosive round?" So he said, "Yeah, try an HE." So we put an HE in, and I was just going to fire it, and he tapped me on the shoulder. And he said, "Hang on, something's happening." And he gave me the binoculars, and I looked at this, and first one and then another of these wooden things was coming off, and water was pouring out in a great spurt. And he said, "Yeah, you must have hit it." And that was the first thing I ever shot at, because it was a water tower. Yeah. But it put an end to the sniping anyway, so.
Do you know whereabouts that was?
I couldn't tell you, no. The one place I remember in Normandy was where it became personal. And I've looked in maps since, and I cannot find this place, but the name stuck in my mind. And I don't know why it is. And I'll come back to the name in a minute. But we'd gone out on a patrol, and there was only the one anti-tank gun on this particular patrol. And the ground in front of us rose fairly steeply, and we were going along the foothills, and we came under mortar fire. So we pulled off the road into this field and started to dig in. And we realised that just below the surface was huge rocks, so it's very difficult to dig in. But one of the armoured car crew had been lucky. They'd found a soft spot, and they'd dug about 2 or 3 feet deep into this thing. And we were thinking of giving up on our slit trench and helping them to make theirs bigger to accommodate us, when a mortar came over and it dropped straight into the slit trench, killed all the three that were in there, blew them to pieces.
Do you know who
they were? There was some of the lads of C Squadron, yeah. I didn't know the names at the time, no.
So that's gave you pause for thought.
And we realised that halfway up this hill there was a building, presumably it was a farm, with a high, about a 10 foot high wall all the way around it. And somebody must have been in the attic of this building, and they could see us, and they were directing the mortars who were in the farm yard, out of sight from us. So we decided that the best thing to do was to move up the hill towards them, to give them a less and less target. The nearer we got to them, the more difficult it became for them to to use the mortars. As you know, the higher the angle gets on a mortar, the less accurate it becomes. So we did, and we were going up this hill, and some of these mortars started coming across, and the side of the road, in nearly all parts of France and Belgium and Holland in those days, the side of each road was a ditch to take the rainwater. And there were some trees along this ditch. And when we came under attack again, we jumped out to go into the ditch. And we noticed that somebody had put a row of logs across this ditch. So we thought, well, that's ideal. So we all crawled underneath there. And I was the last one in. And my legs must have been sticking out. Now, when a mortar hits the ground, the explosion goes upwards. When it hits a tree, it goes sideways, because you change the angle of impact from the horizontal to the vertical, and so the shrapnel goes sideways. And we were all underneath these logs, and I suddenly felt the most horrendous bang on my right leg. And a piece of shrapnel had taken the heel of my boot off, cleanly. And it was only because I was lying on my face downwards, and my feet were sticking out. If I'd have been stood, of course, or braced, it would have broke my ankle. But because my foot was lying loose, it just a horrible knock. And I had to get a new pair of boots that night. But what happened was that there was a sudden burst of machine gun fire in the farmyard, and then silence. And so eventually we plucked up courage, and we rammed the gates with one of the armoured cars and got in. And we don't know what had happened there, But the Germans had shot one of their own kind. And they were all sat on the ground with their hands in the air.
They'd shot one of their own.
Presumably he wanted to surrender, and they didn't. Yeah. And so they'd shot him.
But when you went in, they were surrendered.
Yeah.
How many were there?
Oh, about half a dozen or so. That was the first prisoners we'd ever taken.
Right. And what was the name of that farm?
St. Germain Langer is the name of the village. And I've looked for it everywhere and I can't find it. There are numerous St. Germains. Mm. Presumably that's the name of a saint. Mm. And this was Langer, L-A-N-G-E. And I've never seen it since. But it was only like a little hamlet. Mm. But I'd love to know what happened in that farmyard between the Germans that forced them to shoot one of their own.
And what sort of crew were they? They were an OP or...?
They were the remnants of some infantry battalion.
So you took them prisoner?
Yeah.
Was that easy? I mean.
Oh, yes. Well, we'd been told, you know, that... of course, it's better with hindsight. You can always know these things in hindsight. But apparently... our intelligence people knew the mind of the German military. And they were absolute sticklers, the Germans, apparently, for doing the military correctly every time. And this was a great help, because it meant that if you captured a German prisoner, and he belonged to a particular regiment which you could identify from his insignia, you knew with almost certainty that if he was there and that regiment was there, then this regiment was there and this regiment was there and this support unit would be with them and that would be with them. So you could gain an awful lot of information. Even if the prisoner never said a word to you, you already knew a lot of information just by having him, if he belonged to a particular regiment. And of course the intelligence people knew all this, and they were able to glean so much information from prisoners that was one of our prime objectives, was to take prisoners whenever possible.
So where did you take those prisoners?
Oh, we took them back to our unit HQ, and they passed them on to the Div HQ, and the intelligence people took over.
Do you know where the unit HQ was then?
We never knew, no.
No,
there was a system of liaison, you know, between all the units and so on. But when you're on the ground, of course, you only know what you're doing immediately in front of you at any given time. Yeah.
So did you see much more action in Normandy? What were you doing on a daily basis?
Well, the next time that we really saw action was at Falaise. I don't know if you know what happened at Falaise, but the Americans and the British and the Canadians had a three-pronged pincer movement to drive the Germans into a trap. Mm-hmm. And there they were strafed by the RAF. And the casualties were horrendous.
Mm-hmm. So what was your unit's role in that?
Well, I can relate one incident to you. Again, I don't know the exact position, but quite near to Falaise itself. And we'd set our anti-tank gun up on this road. And in front of us, the road was a straight road, and it went slightly downhill. And say at about half a mile, it started to rise. And at that point, there were some buildings on the right-hand side, which we could see quite plainly. And we set the gun up on the side of the road. And, of course, there was a ditch on the right-hand side as well. And we were on the shoulder of the road. And I think there was myself and Newton and... I forget the old fellow's name now. We called him the old fellow. I think he was 35. And he was my layer. And... we could see vehicles coming from this field on the right-hand side past these vehicles and onto the road that we were on. And, of course, they had to do a sharp right turn to get away from us. And they were just sitting ducks. Every time a vehicle came out and paused to turn, I would let a round off and blow him over into the field. And there was quite a collection of different vehicles scattered across the road, in the ditch, in the field, and what have you. And we were running short of ammunition. I think we'd got about one round left. So we sent the carrier to go and get some more ammunition. And so there was just the three of us and the six-pounder. And we realised when the carrier had gone that we hadn't even got any sidearms with us. We'd no rifles, no revolver, nothing. Just one round and the six-pounder. And the next thing we notice is that there's this man walking up the road towards us, waving a white flag. And as he got nearer, we realised it wasn't a soldier at all. He was a civilian, and he was a little Frenchman. And of course, we hadn't had a chance to learn any French. We'd only been there a few weeks. And anyway, he said, "Have you got cigarettin'?" So we know what that meant, so we gave him some cigarettes. So eventually he explained to us that down at the bottom where we've been knocking all these vehicles on the road, he said there were many, many Germans who want to surrender. He gave us the sign to show they want to surrender. He said, "I will go and fetch them." So we said, "All right, you have some more cigarettes." So off he went. And we were just idly sat there, and nothing was happening, no more vehicles came out. And our carrier never came back with any more ammunition. So we thought, well, we'll have a cigarette, and just sat there. And the next thing we notice is that the road is full of people, absolutely full of them. And leading them is this Frenchman with his white flag. And when they arrived, there were 2,500 German troops, all with a rifle apiece. And we got them to stack the rifle in the ditch.
All three of you?
Yeah. And they were all sat on the road, cross-legged, with their hands on their head. And eventually an officer detached himself and came over, and he said, "Do you have a radio?" So I said, "No." He said, "There are some Tiger tanks." I thought, well, Tiger tanks come here, they've it's goodbye, isn't it? So he said, "If I had a radio," he spoke very good English, he said, "if I had a radio, I could tell them." So he said, "Could I send one of my men?" So I said, "Yeah." So he dispatched one of these men. And the first vehicle that arrived was in fact a private car. I think it was a Citroen. And in it were three German officers. And one of them was brandishing a pistol, which in my position was a bit dicey. Apparently he'd been hit in the groin by a piece of shrapnel, and he was in terrible agony, and he thought he was dying. So I suggested to him that the best thing to do was to drive straight on until he met our troops, you know, and they would take care of him. And the next thing that happened was that two, not three, but two Tiger tanks did turn up and surrendered.
So had you armed yourselves with the German rifles?
No.
Doing a car park job, really?
That's really, yes. And eventually our provost sergeant arrived with his Bremgun carrier and his machine gun, and he got them all on their feet and herded them up and told them to march, and he rode behind them in his Bremgun carrier with his Thompson submachine gun covering them. And that was his day of glory. 2,500. The only noticeable thing there was that Falaise, part of, I think it was from B Squadron, one of their vehicles was actually the first British vehicle to meet up with the American group that came up the road and closed the gap.
So, what was the reaction in your unit to what you'd done? I mean,
well, surprisingly enough, quite a lot of prisoners were taken that day. Our 2,500 was only just part of the batch that was eventually handed over. And our regiment wasn't able to cope with them. You know, they had to pass them on to other people because we didn't have the facility.